got Dan Sheridan and Rick Farwell here too.
Wow.
Oh wow. Hey, if you guys want to pump, pipe in at any point, be happy to. We've been looking at the Book of Matthew. We just finished up looking at the Galilean ministry, and we're going to actually begin to look at his the climax in Judea. So we're going to probably spend the next few weeks looking at that, and tonight's really a basic introduction of that. So if you want to turn into Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. And I want to look at verse 1 here. And it occurred when Jesus finishes these sayings, he withdraws from Galilee and came into the boundaries of Judea, the other side of the Jordan. And the point here is that Jesus was now leaving, he was withdrawing himself from Galilee, and he now was coming into the boundaries of the land of Judea, on the other side of the Jordan. And this really begins a presentation of Jesus. You're going to have really four basic components from Matthew 19 all the way through Matthew 28 now. You're going to have the journey to the city, then you're going to have the entry into the city, excuse me, then you're going to have the clashes he has with the religious leaders in the city itself. Then you're going to have the discourse on Olivet, and then right after that you're going to have the arrest and crucifixion and resurrection of Christ. So you have all these things going on, and tonight I want to kind of give an overview of the first four ideas: the journey into the city, the entry into the city, the clashes in the city, and the discourse on the Olivet Mountain. So I want to begin here with a basic premise that we've kind of touched on back in Matthew chapter 12 and then again in chapter 13. And that's the idea that Israel had already rejected Christ. And part of that is seen by the fact that the Lord begins to speak in parables. And we saw that where he was speaking in parables to hide what he was saying from the unbelievers, but to reveal things to those who really did believe. And the purpose behind that is Jesus sees some things now that are now taking shape. In the past, we've looked at two divergent paths that could happen. The one path would have Jesus come to his people, and they would accept him, and they would then sacrifice him in a loving manner like Abraham with Isaac, and the kingdom would be established. The other path is that they would reject him, and now he knows he's going to still die, but it's not going to be done in a loving manner. Instead, it's going to be done in a hateful kind of a manner, in a way to try to really inflict as much harm as they can upon him and to really discredit him. And he understands by the end of chapter 12, the path Israel is on is leading them to the path of trying to destroy him, not in a loving way, but to totally eradicate him and to destroy him and to discredit his ministry. So there's some things that Jesus foreknows that's going to transpire as he comes in to the boundaries of Judea. And I want to look at a few of these things just briefly so you can see how this plays out. In chapter 20, go on, turn there. In verses 17 through 19. Somebody'd like to read that. That would be great.
Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples apart in the way and said unto them, Behold, we go up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him. And the third day he shall rise again."
Okay, the idea here is he's already beginning to lay out a certain path. And the path he's laying out for them is one that he first mentioned and hinted at and alluded to back in chapter 12. And that's where he mentions the sign of Jonah. Well, now here he begins to elaborate a little bit. In verse 19, for instance, "They will be giving him up to the nations to scoff at and scourge and crucify. And the third day he will be roused." The idea is that he's coming for a specific purpose now. And there's a sign, and he knows that he's going to die, and he knows on the third day that he's going to be made alive again, right? So he begins to elaborate, and he begins to instruct his apostles about this information. He actually began to instruct them a little bit about it right after chapter 16, when Peter makes his confession, that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. He now is going to be going into more detail about that. We can see it again in verse 28 of the same chapter. Chapter 20, verse 28. Somebody would like to read that.
"Even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many."
Okay, and this is another passage where he's talking about the fact that he's giving, let me kind of read it here just so you get a different take on it. "Even as the Son of Mankind came not to be served, but to serve and to give his soul a ransom for many." Now, a lot of people also erroneously take this verse to try to make it that, see, God's saving only a few, right? Because he's only using the word many here. The problem is they don't understand dispensational theology when they make a claim like that, because Jesus' presentation here was to who? Israel in particular, and that's who's in view here. He's offering his soul for the nation so that the nation can be brought to a relationship with him. So you have that idea going on here. He's alluding to it. Look back at verse 17 of chapter 20. Verse 17 through 19. "Now Jesus, being about to go up into Jerusalem, took aside the 12 disciples privately." Now we read this, but I want you to really hit home here one of the things he's going to say in verse 19. "And on the road he said to them, Lo, we are going up into Jerusalem, and the Son of Mankind will be given up to the chief priests and scribes, and they will be condemning him to" what? So he knows he's going to die. And he knows it's going to be a judgment at the hands of who?
The chief priests.
The chief priests and the scribes. It continues, "And they will be giving him up to the nations." In other words, he's even telling us, they're going to be handing me over to the Roman authorities. And he elaborates, "to scoff at and scourge," and he already knows the manner of death, because he knows what's awaiting here. "The third day, he will be roused." So this isn't catching him by surprise. He already knows this course has now been set by Israel's callousness towards him. They've come to a place where there's just outright hostility and rejection to what it is that he's trying to accomplish with them. So he already knows the course that's being set. That's why when you get to Gethsemane, he asks if that cup can pass from him. In other words, that other path that could have been, is there somehow that we could maybe allow that one to come in and not this one? But it's too late. It's already, the die is cast already by the time you've hit the end of chapter 12. So he's coming into the city fully well, knowing this. And as he enters the city, we read of his triumphal entry in chapter 21 of Matthew. And in verses 1 through 17, you really get a good account of that entry. One of the interesting things with that entry is a quotation out of the book of Zechariah. If you look here, it says in verse 4, "Say to the daughter of Zion, lo, your king is coming, to you meek and mounted on an ass, and on a colt the foil of a yoke beast." The idea here is that he's coming, and he's coming mounted on an ass or on a donkey. And again, back in the book of Judges, you see kings come on donkeys. They ride that. If they're riding the horse or a white a steed, it's typically to make war. When they're coming this way, the idea is peace, and the terms of peace are being presented. So we begin to see that. If you look at verse 5 here in Matthew, where you have this quote out of Zechariah, you'll also see that there's another allusion to another passage, and that's in Isaiah. And if you go to Isaiah 42, in verse 11, and it says here, "The wilderness and its cities shall be elated. The hamlets where somberness is dwelling, and the dwellers of the crag shall be jubilant. From the summit of the mountains they shall yell." The idea, again, here is that that entry is going to bring elation, that there's going to be rejoicing with that entry. Come with me to the book of Zechariah for a second. Zechariah 9, verse 9. "Exult exceedingly, daughter of Zion. Raise a joyful shout, daughter of Jerusalem. Behold your king. He shall come to you. Righteous and bringing salvation is he, humble and riding on a donkey." The whole point he's trying to get at here is the fact that he's coming to give a way for them to have salvation. He understands the die is set, that he's going to die, but by this entry, he also is telling us that he's really going to come here and present to the nation in a formal way the terms for them to have peace. That's part of the reason he's at that city. So you have that going on, and then in Psalms 118 you have a quote as well. In Psalm 118 there's a quote here in verse 24 and 26 is what I want to look at. Yep, Psalm 118, verse 24. "This is the day Yahweh has made. Do let us exult and rejoice in it. O Yahweh, do save us indeed. O Yahweh, do prosper us indeed. Blessed in the name of Yahweh, who is he who is coming. We bless you from the house of Yahweh." And it's interesting. Remember, they're crying out as he begins to come in, "Hosanna in the highest," and so forth, which is, again, another quotation out of Psalms. The whole idea that they're getting at, though, is that there are many people within that city that are anticipating the Lord coming to be made king. And the Lord himself is coming to offer himself as king. It's an offer. He's coming on that donkey, offering himself as their king, and what that's going to do is either one of two things. It's the final nail in the coffin, so to speak, or it can allow Israel to somehow recover itself from its own hardness. Now, I just want to speak briefly at the idea of somebody who is hardened, just briefly. I don't want to elaborate on it because I am going to talk about that this weekend. But I do want to show something that's really interesting out of Exodus chapter 10. When we think of somebody hardened, we oftentimes get the idea that they're unrecoverable. And when we even think of, say, for instance, a passage that talks about Pharaoh being hardened, that Pharaoh has no choices at that point, and a path is set for him. And Exodus does not support that idea. Exodus actually lays out something totally different when we read it and really take the words without trying to force an interpretation on them. If you look here at Exodus chapter 10, okay, in Exodus chapter 10, verse 1, Yahweh said to Moses, "Enter to Pharaoh, for I myself have hardened his heart and the hearts of his courtiers, that I may set these my signs among them, and that ye may relate in the ears of your son and your son's son that which I set in action in Egypt, and my signs which I placed among them, that you will know that I am Yahweh." So whose hearts did God or Yahweh harden in verse 1 here?
Pharaoh and his court.
Pharaoh and his court. Okay? Look at verse 7. "Now the courtiers of Pharaoh said to him, 'How long shall this man become a trap to us? Dismiss the men, that they may serve Yahweh their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt perishes?'" Now stop and think about the ramifications of what verse 7 is saying here. Mm-hmm. What is typically taught when we look at this passage is that Pharaoh's heart was hardened so that he could not turn and release Israel, so that God could bring these judgments to bear against Egypt, and he would demonstrate his power by really destroying Pharaoh. The problem is, his court also was hardened with him by God, and her heart was hardened not to release the Israelites. That's what verse 1 is telling us. Yet in verse 7, the majority of those whose hearts were hardened to not release Israel are pleading for the release of Israel. Now think about that. Okay? So, when the Lord is coming in to Jerusalem here, and he's actually in the city, as he's entering that city, it's the same sort of an idea going on here. God desires, God wants the nation to turn to him. And he's going to come to that city with the final presentation of his son so that they could perhaps make a decision to change the course thereon and accept him so that he then would become their king. And it's a bona fide offer. He's coming to do that. And we know it's bona fide because immediately after he comes into the city, what's the next thing that Matthew records? In verse 10, coming down through verse 14 of Matthew 21.
"And when he was coming to Jerusalem, all the city that was moved, saying, 'Who is this?' And the multitude said, 'This is Jesus, the prophet of Nazareth of Galilee. And Jesus went into the temple of God, and cast all of them out that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers, and the seats of them that sold doves, and said unto them, It is written, My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them.
Okay, the first thing he does is he clears out the sanctuary. Now, what's he clearing out?
Money changers.
Money changers are the brokers, right?
Dove sellers.
Right. The brokers, the money changers. What money are they changing?
Changing Roman money or temple money.
That's the whole point, right? They're exchanging the Roman money for the temple money so that they can actually go into the temple and do the services that's required in the temple.
You're
right?
Not allowed to bring Roman money
that's
into
correct.
That temple.
What he's doing is he's eradicating the Roman aspect out of it. He's purifying his temple in that sense. The whole idea he's getting at here is that his nation is to be a clean nation without the taint that's coming from outside influences, so to speak. He calls it that they've made it into a den of thieves. The King James records it. The Concordant records it a burglar's cave. The idea is, though, the word literally means an insurrectionist or a place of one who rebels against. The idea would be rebelling against God's authority is what's going on there. And what he's coming in is he's clearing that out. And the other thing he does, verse 14, and the blind and lame came to him in the sanctuary, and he cures them. Okay? Now follow this. The blind and the lame.
Not allowed.
Right?
Not allowed in there.
Not allowed, but they're coming, and he's curing them.
They're unclean.
They're unclean. But he's curing them. He's making them clean. He's revitalizing them. But if you think about it, the blind is the condition of the nation, isn't it? And the nation is lame and sick and on life support. And he's curing all those things to give credence into who he is. And the fact that his offer is bona fide, I can do this. And here's my credentials. And he begins to perform the miracles so that they can see the credentials at work. Now there's a response. The chief priest and the scribes. Now who's the chief priest? Close. The Sadducees. You would have the chief priest, the scribes, and the Pharisees. Is typically what's going to be recorded oftentimes. The chief priests right now are the Sadducees because they're the ones that are in control of the Sanhedrin. Okay? It's almost like if we think of not U.S. government because that's a bad example, but if we would think of, say, a parliamentary form of government where the party that's in control has all the they're the ones that fill all the cabinet posts and determine what legislation comes forward and what doesn't and so on. Well, so it was at that time as well. The Sadducees had control of the Sanhedrin, so therefore the policy of the Sanhedrin was really dictated to a certain degree by the Sadducees.
Didn't believe in resurrection.
Right, they didn't believe in a resurrection. Herod himself was a Sadducee. Then you have the scribes, and the Pharisees would be the other groups in that mix. And it goes here in verse 15, Now the chief priests and the scribes, perceiving the marvels which he does, and the boys crying in the sanctuary, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, resented, and say to him, Are you hearing what these are saying? Yet Jesus is saying to them, yes. Did you never read that out of the mouth of minors and sucklings thou dost attune praise? And leaving them, he came out of the city into Bethany and his camp out there. The whole point he's getting at here is what Matthew is trying to get at here is that the leaders of Israel, the chief priests and the scribes, understand what Jesus is doing. They understand it and they resent it. And not only do they resent it, but they will formulate a plan to try to ensnare him, to discredit him. But they understand what's going on in front of them. They see it, and they look at it, and it's like, we can't have that. For this to be occurring would then be taking away our authority and our power, and we don't want to do that. They're basically, for lack of a better term, I guess, a typical politician, right?
Very jealous.
Yeah, they're very jealous of their authority and position. So that then brings us into the clashes in the city. And this is where Jesus is going to have confrontations with all three groups. And they're going to try to ensnare Jesus in his own word.
Given over the fig tree.
Well, I didn't get that far yet. Okay. So you have that whole idea here. Now, in verse 18, this context now begins with the idea of the fig tree. And it says here, now in the morning, leading them back into the city, he hungers. And perceiving one fig tree on the roadside, he came to it and found nothing on it except leaves only. And he is saying to it, no longer by any means may fruit be coming of you for the eon. And withered instantly is the fig tree. And perceiving it, the disciples marvel, saying, how instantly withered is the fig tree. Now answering, Jesus said to them, verily I am saying to you, if ye should be having faith and not be doubting, not only that to the fig tree will you be doing, but if you should be saying to this mountain also, be picked up and cast into the sea, it will be occurring. Now, the whole idea of the fig tree is it represents the nation. It has leaves that looks like it's going to sprout. It looks like it should have fruit. They say the right things. They're, from the outward appearance, they appear righteous, but there's no fruit. It's barren.
Where else do you think the fig leaves?
Well, again, you would have it back in the garden.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And this is where it's so hard to figure Jesus out.
Yeah.
Because he goes to the wedding feast in Cana.
Right.
And they run out of wine.
Right.
So what does he do? Curse the joint and say, no more festivities for you all. I'm thirsty. There's no wine. I'm going to some other gig. No. He makes wine.
Right.
Here, he could have stepped up to this fig tree and said, bear abundantly the best fig that the planet has ever seen. No. He doesn't do that.
Right.
He curses the fig tree.
Sure.
And then you got to get somebody to cut the thing down and get rid of it. Which, of course, that's what you're going to do.
Well,
I have to do the symbolism here.
Yeah.
But
there's the symbolism of the fact that it represents them. In particular, their son.
What brought that about, though, was the fact that he said, and if you have faith, not only would you be able to do the fig tree thing, but you'd be able to move the mountain, too.
Sure.
And it's like, well, fig tree is a curse. It's an unpleasant thing. But to fill a tree with figs when there weren't any, that would be a thing.
Yeah. Pick up a mountain would be pretty incredible,
too. Picking up a mountain, that would be very nice.
Yeah. And I think the whole point is, obviously, there's some symbolism there that he's trying to show to them as a nation, and in particular to his apostles that are with him.
So would you say that the fig tree represents hypocrisy?
No, it actually represents the nation. It's the national standing of that nation.
The fruitlessness of the nation
itself. And the fact that as as a nation, they're barren. They're totally devoid of the spiritual life they should be having.
Not winning any Gentiles in, though.
They're not doing anything the way that they should be. And what you have being laid out then is a contest that's going to begin where they're going to continue to come to Jesus and question him and ask him questions. And they're going to do that where they think they're clever. You know, human reasoning sometimes thinks it's pretty clever. And it'll come and it'll say, well, what are you going to do here? And they come up with some hypotheticals and they ask questions. And then Jesus answers their questions, but then ensnares them in their own questions to the point of where they're really humiliated by the time he's done with them. So much so that they don't even ask him any more questions at the end of it because they know that they can't debate him. You know, he's beyond their ability to debate.
So when you're talking about the mountain, is it government? Is it just a graduation? Or is it just a
here? Well, I think the whole point he's getting at is that if you have enough faith, this isn't so marvelous because you can do many more marvelous things, some things much greater than this with faith. I think the whole point is faith, and he just used the idea of a mountain and a sea to take something that was really, that they would look at impossible, to say, if you have faith with my power, it's not impossible.
It's
we
like
we
an,
could do that.
It's not an exaggeration, but it's like a
more
of example.
Right. Right.
Because we don't have any example of a mountain being moved, do we?
No.
Not in Scripture. No precedent for that.
No.
Not yet, anyway.
Not yet. So, you know, I think the main point he's trying to get at is faith here. And what he's giving them is a lesson on faith. The leaders of Israel are barren without faith. You, the apostles, and the disciples traveling with him have faith. Don't let your faith waver and become like theirs. And he demonstrates what their faith is like by allowing the fig tree to wither up and basically be a dead tree just sitting there. The idea is that he's looking at it and showing them in a visual way the difference between the faith of the religious leaders of the nation and the faith that they're to have. And to continue to have. You know, and by the end of all of it, I'm not going to really get into a lot of discussions on the parables and that he gets into here. We'll talk about that in length as we begin to break down the sections. Like I said, tonight's just an introduction. But he gets into some really important discussions here, and as he gets into them, the end result is that they're silent. And if you look at chapter 22, in verse 46, if somebody wants to read that would be great.
And he answered him a word. Nor from that day on did anyone dare question him anymore.
That was the end result of the debate. The end result of the debates is that nobody was able to answer him and that nobody would ask any more questions of him because he totally silenced them. Kind of gives a little bit of an insight when Paul talks about stopping the mouth of individuals, right, in the book of Titus. Well, the idea is that you're to be able to have that kind of authority of the Word of God to be able to do that to your critics, that you can totally silence them. Now, again, the problem here is they can't answer him and they can't ensnare him that way, so now they have to figure out a different way to get rid of him. And that's where they're going to hatch a plot to get him killed. And they enlist one Judas Iscariot to assist them in that plot. But it's kind of an interesting thing. Now, on the chapter 23, if you look at chapter 23 here, after they're all silent, chapter 23 has a public denunciation of the Pharisees. And he gets into woe, right? The King James uses the phrase, woe unto you. Woe to you, blind guides. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, and so forth. He has eight of those. Now, again, I'm not going to elaborate on it tonight, but there's eight Beatitudes. Eight woes. And if you really take the time to really study it out, you're going to see that they coincide. And there's a relationship between the two. The kingdom, the citizens of the kingdom are happy because of certain things, and the scribes and Pharisees have woe pronounced upon them because of their failure to adhere to certain things. And there's that contrast that goes on. He calls them one other name too, which is interesting. That's the name hypocrite. He calls them hypocrites a number of times in this passage. The word hypocrite is, again, it's an old English term, and it was used for actors. If you went to a Shakespearean play, for instance, it would have the cast of hypocrites, and it would list a character in the play and the actor that played the part. And by calling them hypocrites, he's basically accusing them of play acting. They're playing a role.
They're pretending
and impersonating to be something they're not, is the idea. At the end of that, in verse 37, he's going to withdraw from the city, but he's also going to see some things in regards to the city. Verse 37, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who art killing the prophets and pelting with stones those who have been dispatched to her. How many times do I want to assemble your children in the manner a hen is assembling her brood under her wings, and ye will not? Lo, left is your house to you desolate, for I am saying to you, you may by no means be perceiving me henceforth till you should be saying, blessed is he who is coming in the name of the Lord. Now, that ends chapter 23 after he's had this public denunciation of the scribes, Pharisees. Right on the heels of that, he's leaving the city, verse 24, or chapter 24, verse 1, and coming out. Jesus went out from the sanctuary, and his disciples approached to exhibit to him the buildings of the sanctuary. Yet he answering said to them, are you not observing all these? Verily I am saying to you, under no circumstances may a stone here be left on a stone which shall not be demolished. Now it's interesting.
Hey, Phil?
Yes?
I hate to interrupt, but is it possible to call my house phone? My cell phone is almost out of battery.
Yeah, I can do that. So we stay connected and I call Ted, yeah?
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead and hang up, Ted, and I call you.
Okay.
We'll put it on the timeout.
Okay, 1 second here.
There you go. Now if we were in Jeopardy, it would be
hello everybody.
And welcome back.
For some reason, it still see me. I only can do one conference. I may have to hang up. John, can you call me back?
That's okay. I have I can call him on my cell phone.
Why don't you stay connected, Greg?
Okay. And you guys call Ted. You get his number, huh?
His house number is 330-638-1551.
Correct.
And it's ringing.
Hello?
Hello, are you there, Ted?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Can you hear okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So we are actually going to look here at chapter 24 and verse 1 is where we left off. I feel like a TV show where we just had a commercial break. That's kind of cool. So chapter 24, verse 1. In coming out, Jesus went from the sanctuary, and his disciples approached to exhibit to him the buildings of the sanctuary. Yet he, answering, said to them, "Are you not observing all these? Verily I am saying to you, under no circumstances may a stone here be left on a stone, which shall not be demolished." Now it is sitting on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what is the sign of thy presence and of the conclusion of the eon?" Now, it's interesting here. In chapter 23, we had him where he had railed on the scribes and the Pharisees. Then he lamented the city itself, placed a charge on their footstep, really, that they're the ones killing the prophets and so on. And then he says that her house is going to be left to her desolate. And then he says that "You may by no means be perceiving me henceforth, so you should be saying, blessed is he who is coming in the name of the Lord." So the idea he has here is there's only one thing left for you, and that's judgment. It's on the heels of that he's withdrawn himself outside of the city now, and as he's outside of the city, he begins to utter a prophecy now about the destruction of the city and judgment that's now going to befall her. Is a people, and not only her but the nation as a whole, and he's going to elaborate on that in some detail in this chapter and the next, in chapter 25. But what he's saying here is, a result, I want you to really grasp this, as a result of the fact that you have rejected me as your king, this is what now is coming. Now, the Old Testament had hinted at it, and there's a lot of passages in the Old Testament that lay out events that we would look at that would be taking place that he's talking about here in Matthew chapter 24. Oftentimes, those events are called the Day of Yahweh or the Day of the Lord, depending on the translation one would be reading. He alludes to the book of Daniel, for instance, with the abomination of desolation and certain things that he gets into a discussion about there. The whole point of it all, and I want to hit home this point because we'll elaborate it in the future, and I'll probably have everybody disagree with me, and that's okay. That's good. Disagreement, let me paraphrase this. Disagreement is not a bad thing. Unless as believers we allow it to become a bad thing. Sometimes when you disagree with one another, it forces you to look at things that maybe you wouldn't have looked at to come to a better understanding about what it is that God is trying to communicate to us. And that's always a good thing. So, you know, the only thing I can always say in regards to that is when we get into things where we may not agree, just give it a fair hearing. Try not to approach it with a preconception that this is the way it is and this is not the way it is. And you want to give it a fair hearing. And by giving it a fair hearing, you're going to allow the scriptures to maybe communicate to you in a way they want it. And this might be one of those passages when we get here. But the whole point he's getting at here is the stage has been set. The city itself has now rejected him. The only thing left is judgment. Now, my question is, what would have happened had the city accepted him?
Offered on the altar.
He would have been offered on the altar. He would have been bound with the cords of sacrifice placed upon the horns of the altar. His throat would have been split quickly, expeditiously. He would have died very swiftly. He still would have rose on the third day, and he would have ushered in a kingdom. Would the Olivet Discourse have been different? My answer to you is yes.
Sure.
Because Israel wouldn't be under judgment.
There would be no time of kicking stones.
That's correct. So this is a contingency that was laid out in the Old Testament as a possibility. And now what Jesus is laying out is that possibility is becoming a reality.
Future reality.
Is becoming a future reality. So one of the things when we look at this, I want to kind of go through, when we get to chapter 24, I want to get into what some passages are that could possibly have been contingencies into that. And I think that will be an interesting study when we get to that. So, you know, just keep that in your mind, though, that this is a judgment that is being pronounced right on the heels of him lamenting the city and pronouncing that the house is left to them desolate. It's because they have rejected him and his offer as he has been in the city, and now he withdraws from the city. And as he withdraws from the city, he's going to give his last great public discourse. And by doing so, he's going to pronounce judgment and lay out the way that the course is now being set for them, and how it is that it's going to culminate. And he begins to lay out that information. It's kind of interesting because he's going to tie in some real familiar Old Testament passages for us in this chapter, but on the same token, he's going to give it maybe a little bit different spin than what we've typically think of when we read about some of those things in the Old Testament. So you have that going on here, and he's laying out here, this is the future. Because you've rejected, this now has to transpire, and this is what the conclusion of the eon is going to look like. And he now lays it out. So there's a reason why he hasn't elaborated on a lot of these things up until you hit this point. And the reason he begins to elaborate on it is because they have now rejected him within the city after he has made the offer. Remember earlier when he had fed the thousands of people with the fish and the bread, right? And they wanted to make him king there. But he wasn't looking at a kingdom the way they were trying to establish it, so he declined that offer. Here, from chapter 19 up through chapter 23, he's laying out what his offer of the king and the kingdom is to be, and they turned him down now.
Why?
Well, again, for a lot of different reasons. From the perspective of the scribes, Pharisees, and the Sadducees, they turn them down because they don't want to give up their power. From the perspective of the citizens within the city, as a whole, now there's exceptions. I mean, there's believers in the city, but as a whole, they turn them down because they want somebody that's going to violently overthrow Rome. And he's not teaching that or proclaiming that. They're looking for somebody to immediately come in and throw off the yoke of bondage and to start a revolution right at that point. A rebellion to overthrow what they perceive to be their oppressors. And that's what they're looking for.
But yet the rulers appreciated the relationship they had with them,
right.
the oppressors,
right.
because of the luxuries that were afforded them.
That's correct. And it's funny because the rulers are playing like both sides of the fence. They give lip service to the population. Yeah, we hate Rome. We hate Roman oppression. Yet they're doing everything to nurture that relationship with Rome. So
that's why they had to accuse Christ before
right.
Pilate as being claiming he was king of the Jews.
Right, and that's exactly what was
we have no king but Caesar.
Right, and that was interestingly enough is the accusation that they brought to bear against him. He said he's king of the Jews. So and even the inscription that Pilate put above the cross, right?
Yeah.
He has the reference that he's the king of the Jews in the inscription.
He said, no. This is the king of the Jews.
This is the king of the Jews.
That's what
and they wanted
Pilate
to change it to he said.
He said.
Because
yeah.
Pilate wouldn't crucify him for blasphemy.
No. Well, he couldn't.
The legal authority.
The only way he could crucify him is if it was a charge of sedition against the Roman government. Hence that accusation. Which, interestingly enough, is what he came into Jerusalem to be. So, in a sense, it was a true inscription in that sense. He did come to be the king of the Jews. So, when you look at all that, it's really a fascinating thing. But, that's really an overview of the presentation of this Judean ministry, for lack of a better term. Like I said before, you have the presentation journey, right? The second phase would be the crucifixion, and the third phase would be the resurrection. This is phase one of the Judean ministry that we just kind of went through in a quick fashion tonight. And we'll spend some more time on certain aspects of it and look at it.
Journey. The first one was journey.
The first part is the presentation. The presentation journey, for lack of a better term. If you look up at the chart at the top of the page.
I left it.
Oh, okay.
We actually
had new ones. Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
Oh, it's time. So, if you look at that, there's where it talks about the climax in Judea. You have the presentation, then you would have the crucifixion, and then the resurrection. And that would constitute his Judean ministry. So, that's a basic overview. Like I said, we'll spend more time on some of the sections. Some of them we'll skim over. I don't want to be a Matthew for the rest of the year either. So, we'll kind of pick and choose what we really elaborate on a lot. But any questions on Matthew up to this point? Does it make sense?
Oh, yeah.
Any questions from Ohio? Anything you want to add?
Rick is really drunk, so.
Hey, I've been
up since 2 o'clock this morning.
Oh, okay. That's kind of tough to.
I don't know. pretty good. So you get some sleep, Rick. Well, I'll let you guys go, and we'll see you sometime tomorrow.
Stay on your Bible study, Bill.
Well, thank you. Well,
this is Dan Sheridan.
Hi, Dan.
I want to say I appreciate it. I like you. I don't care what Rick says about you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. We'll see you guys. Yep. Have a good one, guys.
Okay.
Good night.
Good night.
See you, Greg.